dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In spite of passionate opposition by people here and abroad, as well as the majority of foreign governments, the Bush administration unleashed an attack that has already led to many, many deaths, which are being reported by the foreign but not American media. The prevailing U.S. media message is, now that war has begun, Americans should cease opposition. But this is impossible. For those of us disgusted and outraged by a war of aggression, by war generally, or by the totality of the actions and policies of the government of the United States, many people feel that democracy has failed and that America and the world are in crisis. Tonight on the program, the subject is war resistance, both among civilians and members of the U.S. military.
No fat rich man's pony can overtake you. There's not a rider from east to the west.
Worldwide protest erupted this week against the invasion of Iraq. Especially in the Arab world, protests became violent. According to yellowtimes.org, Yemen's capital, Sana'a, looked like a battleground as four Yemenis were killed in violent clashes with police trying to push protesters back from storming the U.S. embassy. The Arabic language news service Al Jazeera also showed footage of a massive explosion in the U.S. embassy compound in Manama, Bahrain, home to a large contingent of U.S. forces. It is not known whether it was a small bomb or a Molotov cocktail. Bahraini youth battled riot police as they tried to storm the U.S. embassy. Images of dead and injured Iraqi civilians filled the media overseas as the massive bombardment continues. U.S. flags were burned in protests, and U.S. embassies were targeted on every continent. Here in the U.S., protests shut down San Francisco city center for 3 straight days with calls to continue protest until war stops. More than 2,000 people have been arrested there. In Chicago, more than 1,000 were arrested in civil disobedience protests, and mass arrests also took place on Saturday after hundreds of thousands marched against the war in New York City. Civil disobedience of various forms took place in towns large and small as well, including here in central New York. On Thursday, following the announcement of war, a crowd of more than 500 people, composed of everyone from grandparents to toddlers, took the streets in downtown Syracuse, calmly ignoring police orders to clear the street. 8 people were arrested for blocking the street in Ithaca that same day. Most U.S. media outlets have given little coverage to protests, especially now that war has begun, and the coverage that has been given has often been treated derisively. Meanwhile, Americans have been subjected to such a barrage of propaganda that half the people now apparently believe that Iraq was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Instead, the familiar call to support our troops is used to silence dissent. One might ask, if one is concerned about the lives of friends and family serving in the U.S. military, how does one justify as support encouraging them to be used in a war launched by and for the benefit of a group of greedy and power-mad government officials and their corporate cronies? 4 members of Ithaca's Catholic worker community had a different idea about the meaning of supporting those in the military. On March 17th, Peter DeMott, Daniel Burns, Teresa Grady, and Claire Grady all entered the Military Recruitment Center in Ithaca, New York, with jars filled with human blood, which they poured on the walls, door, window, on the flag, on the stand-up cutouts of smiling military recruits, and over a body bag which they brought, representing American soldiers who will die in the onslaught on Iraq. They knelt in prayer as 30 supporters on the other side of town confronted the editor of the Ithaca Journal about its failure to cover war in a truthful way, and to tell readers of the costs of war, to civilians in Iraq, to the soldiers for whom 100,000 body bags have been sent to Kuwait in readiness, and to the people of Ithaca who will suffer as needed funds are diverted for war-making. The resistors issued a statement calling on, quote, our brothers and sisters in the military, refuse to fight, refuse to kill. The statement read as follows. You are being ordered to war by a president who was never elected, who has never fought in a war, and who is saying that it is acceptable to use nuclear weapons. You are being ordered to war in the footsteps of veterans who more than 10 years ago were sent to fight in the first Gulf War. Many of those vets returned with severe and unacknowledged illnesses. Many gave birth to severely deformed children. Many were abandoned by the Veterans Administration. You are being ordered to war by the most powerful nation on earth. You are being ordered to war by a nation with the most destructive weapons ever conceived, developed, deployed, or used. You are being ordered to war by a nation whose self-acknowledged posture is that of world domination, mastery, control. This nation can have no moral justification for war. We, the undersigned, are convinced that war is the greatest evil on earth. We believe that humankind must end war, or war will end humankind and, in fact, all of creation. Our convictions have driven us time and time again to the Pentagon, White House, and Congress in acts of civil resistance to war. Now we bring our plea to you, sisters and brothers in the armed forces. Refuse to kill. Refuse the order to go to war. Leave the military before it's too late. We know your resistance to war will be difficult and require great courage. There are groups established for the express purpose of counseling and supporting military resistors. To find out about your rights to conscientiously object to war, call the GI Rights Hotline at 1-800-394-9544 or 1-800-FYI-95-GI. As you consider this plea, we ask that you reflect. Is non-cooperation more difficult than fighting in war? Is non-cooperation more difficult than being a pawn of corporate greed? Is non-cooperation more difficult than living with a violated conscience? Is non-cooperation more difficult than living with the poisons of war in your body and spirit? Wrong is easy, right is difficult and long. Do what your heart says is right. We knowingly and willingly make this plea to you in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1381 and 2387. We knowingly and willingly embrace some of your risk by urging you to refuse duty in the U.S. military. We plead with you as Bishop Oscar Romero pleaded with the Salvadoran troops. When you hear the words of a man telling you to kill, remember instead the words of God, "Thou shalt not kill." No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. In the name of God, in the name of our tormented people who have suffered so much and whose laments cry out to heaven, I beseech you, I beg you, I order you in the name of God to stop the repression. If you choose to leave the military, please know that our hearts and homes are open to you. That was a statement from members of the Ithaca Catholic Worker Community who engaged in civil disobedience at a recruiting office last week. The four were arrested and held on $500 bail. Rebellion inside the military does happen, and it is sometimes violent. On March 23rd, the London Independent reported that an American soldier was detained after grenades exploded at a U.S. base in Kuwait, killing one officer and wounding 13 others in the 101st Airborne Division. The attacker threw three grenades into three tents, including the command tent, military officials said. The motive in the attack, quote, most likely was resentment, unquote, said Max Blumenfeld, a U.S. Army spokesman. He did not elaborate. According to Dave Blalock, a Vietnam veteran who now works to help those inside the military who choose not to fight, such incidents of soldiers attacking officers, termed fragging, happened many times during the Vietnam War. He spoke to an indie media reporter at the European Social Forum in Italy earlier this year about resistance inside the armed forces.
My name is Dave Blalock. I'm with an organization called Vietnam Veterans Against the War Anti-Imperialist, and I'm also with a group here in Europe, in Germany, called Stop the War Brigade. And it's made up of veterans from different countries, different imperialist power countries. We have members from the Russian Army, from the German Army, the U.S. Army, and the French Army. And this is what we do is go around and we support all the soldiers who refuse to fight in the wars.
And are there many of those soldiers?
Well, there wasn't the last Gulf War, and now it's built up again where we've had a lot of contact, especially with the Americans. And there's a lot of debate and discussion going on inside the barracks, a lot. And from our take on it anyway, it appears that there's quite a few people just don't want to go, including some lower-level officers, they think it's bullshit, it's a bullshit war. It's just a blood for oil war, as one man said. He said, blood for oil war, and I'm not ready to give my blood or take anybody else's blood for that oil.
And so how do you give these soldiers support?
Well, what we do is we encourage them to organize their own ways of resisting the war. They can do what they want to do. I know in the Vietnam War, I was my first anti-war demonstration of my life. I was a soldier in Vietnam when I did it, November 15, 1969. And what we did is we held a one-day general strike on our camp, and we shut it down and protested against the war. And other soldiers in Vietnam were killing their own officers. 90 officers were killed that year by their own men with hand grenades. These are infantry soldiers. You had mutinies going on. You had major underground newspaper organizations in the United States, inside the military in the States, and also in Germany. And this movement really made it very hard and almost impossible for the U.S. to continue to wage the Vietnam War. It forced them to basically pull out. Now, in the last Gulf War, the same thing happened. Even before the war started, you had over 2,000 American soldiers put into prison for refusing to fight. This was from August of 1989 until January of 1990 when the war started. There were 2,000 who refused. And they could not wage a ground war in Iraq. They can only do bombing, but they could not go on the land, because that's how you win a war. You have to occupy a country to change it. If you don't have soldiers on the ground, you cannot do that. And boy, I mean, Colin Powell, if you remember him, Colin Powell used to be an officer in Vietnam, a lower-level officer. And Colin Powell all the officers remembered the Vietnam War and the collapse of the armed forces. There was a major article written in the Armed Forces Journal International in June of 1971, and the title of that article is called The Collapse of the Armed Forces. And they compared the United States military to the Tsar's army in Russia in 1917. I mean, the U.S. was, everything was falling apart.
Do you think that anything like that would happen again, given that the U.S. can now wage war without going in?
Well, the one thing is they cannot occupy Iraq unless they have soldiers on the ground. That's still the reality.
But they can maybe do a lot of damage and maybe get the oil.
Well, they still cannot occupy the country without soldiers on the ground. That's the reality of it. And if you notice in the Kosovo War, they had people somewhat brainwashed because they had Milosevic, and we must help the Serbs. Well, the Albanians helped the Albanians. That's what I got confused. The Albanians, that was the big thing. Everybody thought, oh, we must help the Albanians. And many soldiers were confused by that point, but not too many soldiers are confused by this stuff now, because people are very clear. But all the soldiers that we talked to called this as a blood for oil war, and they don't want to fight in a blood for oil war. There's no purpose. They see no purpose in going in there.
So what have you been doing here in Social Forum?
Well, we came down here a lot because we're to make contacts, basically. We don't have any contacts with the Italians too much until now. And so now we have contacts with a lot of the peace movement in Italy. And so we want to establish links with them and encourage them, because it's a peace movement itself that's going to go around to the U.S. military bases. We can't do it all. We're not a big organization. We're made up of individuals in our group, and we go around to where we can go to support the soldiers, but it's the peace movement itself that's going to do it. in the Gulf War, you had the peace movement then in Germany. What they were doing was you had some groups would set up a 24-hour presence in front of U.S. military bases. They did that in Heidelberg. They did that in Rhineland Air Force Base. They did that in Fulda, a big U.S. Army base in Fulda, and some other areas of the country. And this 24-hour presence then allowed for soldiers who, when they could walk by and ask questions and get contact. I know in February of 91, I gave a speech in front of the Heidelberg headquarters. There were several thousand protesters. I didn't know if the soldiers heard me or not. 3 hours after I got home from the speech, the demos were over, but the table was still there. Soldiers came out that night, talked to the people at the peace table, said, listen, we want to contact that man who spoke. We want to get in touch with him. They organized a way for us to reach them. We sat down and had meetings. They, in turn, organized a bigger group of infantry who were getting ready to go to the Gulf War. They didn't want to go. They wanted to refuse it publicly. And so that's the kind of stuff that the peace movement has to do this. And we think it's very important.
I mean, one could say that anyone that's a paid-up member of the armed services at the moment, they kind of know what they've been in for. All of the last wars of the last 50 years from Britain, from Europe, from the United States have all been wars of imperialism.
Well,
you could say that.
Right. But see, most people don't know that. Most young people, they don't teach you that. The Americans, they don't teach you that in school. Most kids are taught that. They say, oh, okay, Vietnam was a mistake. That's all they say. They can say. They say nothing about anything in the past 50 years at all. Really, they get no education on it. And as a matter of fact, most of these soldiers are forced in because of economic necessities, of the massive poverty that exists among a large section of the American population. The American soldiers now, a lot of the black guys, especially the white people too, they're inside there because they don't have nothing on the outside. You don't have any possibilities for anything in the United States unless your family has money. If your family has money, it's okay, you don't have to go. But if you're a normal working class or poor people, you don't have a chance. And when you're young, you believe a lot of the BS that the military puts out to you. When you're in high school, they'll come in and show you, oh, join the army, you can learn the new skills, and they don't tell you you're going to fight a war. You come in to learn the skills and this and this and this.
And people have to be pretty naive to think that, well,
let me say something to you. When you are 18 years old and your family, you're living in your family, they're dirt poor, they don't have no money, and you think you have to do something with your life, you can become a criminal or you could try to say be a respectable life, but your options are very limited, and basically the military gives you that option. Now, once you're inside, why shouldn't a soldier have the right to say, bullshit, this is wrong? Why not? Only the big generals can do this? Only the rich politicians can do that? No. Why shouldn't the average, they're human beings too. The soldiers should have the same right as anybody else to decide what they're going to do. And that's the bottom line on it. And actually, in the Vietnam War, the U.S. military learned that big because we just said, you, we're not fighting in your war no more. And we're going to refuse you. We'll do sabotage. We'll do everything we can, but we're getting the hell out of this war. And I said, I joined the army too. I says, I don't care. I didn't join to go over there and massacre civilians. But that's what we did. That's what we were doing. We were fucking massacring millions. 3 million Vietnamese were killed by the Americans. 70% of them were civilians. We dropped 30 million tons of bombs on that country. Twice as much as all powers dropped on each other in World War II. We dropped 18 million gallons of Agent Orange chemicals on that land, deforming the whole half of the whole countryside, deforming this, the whole environmental basis of life in huge areas are deformed. Deformed children were born. But that was, I'm not going to obey that. I'm not going to be like Adolf Hitler's armies or a good German and say, oh, I must obey. I'm a German, a good German. I'm not a good German. I'm not a good American either. I'm a human being, and I think I encourage the young generation, and they are doing it. The young generation is much more advanced today than we were when I was a teenager. They see bullshit. No, definitely. Definitely they are. It took us 4 years to start seeing what was going on in the Vietnam War. Today's generation, the beginning of the Gulf War, boom, you had individuals who had been in the military. But one of the first men who refused in the Gulf War, his name was Jeff Patterson. He was based in Hawaii. He had been in the Marine Corps for 4 years already. He had been in 4 years, and he studied a lot. He started thinking about this. He says, wait a minute. He called the press. He says he's refusing to deploy to Saudi Arabia to fight in the Gulf War. He sits down right in front of the plane and refused. He says it's a blood for oil war, and he had his information. He did some study. Now, the younger generation can do that. We weren't that educated, but there's the movement. There's a peace movement that's been out there. The legacy from the Vietnam War is still alive. Our generation isn't dead yet. And I think that the younger generation is a little bit more hip. And I think that's what the anti-war movement has to do, is get out there and support these soldiers who are inside there, who want to have, they need some help. They're alone. And when you're inside the military, it's a very oppressive situation. The officers control everything you do. If you step out of line, boom, you can go to jail. And that's the way it is. And I think the peace movement is a duty and obligation to go there and support the soldiers and encourage them to refuse, resist, and rebel.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you have one final message?
I think I just said my final message. Refuse, resist, and rebel.
Dave Blalock, Vietnam veteran against war, speaking to an indie media reporter earlier this year in Italy. Not all resistance inside the military involves acts of violence, of course. Most does not. Next, on the subject of war resistance among military personnel, I'd like to read you a lengthy article written by Michael Slate and published in the Revolutionary Worker newspaper. Slate is a journalist who also does a weekly program on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. The article is entitled "Gulf War Vets Resisting and Telling the Truth" by Michael Slate. Slate wrote, "Just about every guy I knew when I was a teenager ended up in Vietnam. The draft board buses used to load up outside the steel mill, and they were packed full. Week after week, year after year. Everybody just staring out the window. No smiles, no laughs, sometimes a few wet eyes. A whole lot of the guys never came back. Some came back with no legs or missing arms. And many came back to our streets consumed by day-long nightmares. And still many others came back to oppose the Vietnam War and speak out so that everyone could know the truth about the war. America always claims its wars are just and noble, all about freedom. Some folks still buy the okey-doke on this, but a whole lot don't. Because of their experience as soldiers in an imperialist military fighting an unjust war, vets have a special ability and responsibility to speak the truth to the rest of us. Lots of youth join the military today because they're looking for a job, college money, a way to see the world while they figure out what they're going to do with their lives. They didn't think they're going to war. And a lot of people figure that even if they do end up in a war, the TV news showed how clean and neat the 1990-1991 Gulf War was. A video game war with smart bombs and precision missiles. But many of the vets who fought the war, not to mention the Iraqi people who were the victims of the war, know all too well that this is a horrendous lie. Almost 700,000 U.S. troops served in the Gulf War between August 2, 1990, and July 31, 1991. As many as 100,000 of these troops suffer from what is known as the Gulf War Syndrome. They were exposed to repeated low levels of chemical warfare agents, including sarin, cyclosarin, and mustard gases. 8,000 troops received botulinum toxoid, Botox vaccine, and 150,000 got the anthrax vaccine as part of some human experimentation routine. At least 436,000 soldiers entered into or lived for months in areas contaminated by more than 315 tons of toxic waste from radioactive depleted uranium from U.S. ammunition. Almost all of these troops had no awareness about the dangers, no training or protective equipment, and no medical evaluations. On the Iraqi side, somewhere around 100,000 Iraqi soldiers were killed by Operation Desert Storm. More than 1 million Iraqi civilians have died since the Gulf War from the effects of the bombings and the economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. Many more could die in a new U.S. war on Iraq. U.S. military veterans who fought in the Gulf War know the real story behind the official American story. They live what they saw and what they did. As U.S. imperialism rushes toward another war on Iraq, many of those vets feel compelled to tell what they experienced firsthand about U.S. crimes in Iraq. And some of the vets tell the story of how they resisted during the Gulf War. they feel a responsibility to help build the anti-war movement today and to help the soldiers facing a new Gulf War do the right thing. Andrew McGuffin is quiet and calm these days. He says it took him a long time to get there. He started out dirt poor in Beckley, West Virginia. He's a lawyer now, a far cry from the penniless youth who stood alone in San Diego more than 12 years ago. No high school degree, no job, no nothing. He was a kid when he joined the Marine Corps, and he hoped it would turn his life around. Today he talks about how he was drafted by poverty. I went to Marine combat training and then to School of Infantry. While I was in School of Infantry, about 12 days before I graduated, the Iraqi forces invaded Kuwait. 4 days after I graduated, I was on my way there. We really didn't know it was going to be Iraqis until August, and by that time there were only a couple of weeks of training left. But it was immediately impressed upon me that the Iraqis were subhumans, through various epithets about their head attire or whatever. There were all kinds of pejorative terms that were used to describe anybody of Muslim or Arab descent. There was one song that we used to sing as we ran. It was, "Gonna rape, kill, pillage, and burn. Gonna rape, kill, pillage, and burn." And that's something we sang quite a bit. And we talked about, quote, "Blood makes the grass grow, we make the blood flow." The Marine Corps went from Saudi Arabia into Kuwait. We infiltrated in the night through various minefields, concertina wire, and obstacle belts. When I got there, I saw the fires from the oil wells, smoke filling the sky, fires 50, 75, 100 feet in the air, and people dying. People dying from mines, from automatic weapons fire, from our planes killing them, from us killing them with machine guns and mortar fire and artillery fire. It was horrific. It was non-stop horror. It just wasn't covered in the U.S. media because the government didn't want the American people to be fully informed about what we were doing there or what was happening to the troops. I had the knowledge of an infantryman that depleted uranium tank shells could easily penetrate the armor of Iraqi tanks. I didn't have the knowledge that depleted uranium would cause lifelong illness to the people who were exposed to the particles that are airborne from firing depleted uranium shells. I didn't know that the bombs that were being dropped by our aircraft or by our artillery were coated in depleted uranium. I didn't know that countless thousands of Iraqi children would be dying from depleted uranium illnesses. Another one of the things that really disturbed me while I was there was just seeing the massive destruction of the landscape, the harm to the environment. But most of all, it was burning people around the highways, around Kuwait City, the infamous highway of death, those people who were just annihilated. There can be no doubt in anybody's mind who sees the pictures from what happened there that that was a crime against humanity, a war crime. It still affects me to this day. The smell of burning people is very much like the smell of burning hair, but of course most people who smell burning hair only smell it in small doses, and when it's people, it's much more prominent and disturbing. It's a smell I don't think anyone can ever forget once they've smelled it. I had to go for oral surgery at some point, and something was cut out of my mouth with a cauterizing gun. I smelled that, and it immediately took me back to Kuwait and what I experienced there. It's just the most horrible smell, and almost immediately you know what it is. Not only are there the smells, but also the visions of the wrecked and bombed vehicles being mashed into the road, mashed into craters, or just incinerated with people incinerated around them, or seeing the dead who have died from gunshot wounds who are really, really messed up. The firepower of an automatic weapon or a heavy machine gun will really, really destroy a human body, and it's not a pretty sight. It not only changes your mind, but it makes you carry a burden of shame and guilt about participating in those things for the rest of your life. I think it's a sadness that I'll bear with me for the rest of my life. the things that I was participating in was our units killing people in trench lines across the minefields and taking lots of prisoners or not taking them. There was an incident where we took an Iraqi officer prisoner and turned him over to our intelligence officer. From my understanding, the Iraqi officer wanted to have his troops be able to surrender to our forces. But because of the emphasis on moving forward and getting to Kuwait City and being on the attack, the intelligence officer apparently just called artillery on these people and blew them up. A lot of the people that we encountered who were prisoners of war, our prisoners, were people who were starving, who had been bombed for a month, who were barely holding on to their sanity, and were very much like me. They were poor people. They were uneducated by and large. They were not really wanting to be there for any personal reasons, but having been told by their government that they were there for the right reasons. Perhaps they felt compelled to be there, either conscripted or whatever their situation might be. I think that the concept of supporting the troops is such a lie. I think that when I got back, and there were all these parades and people treating me like I was some war god, it really confused me more than anything, because I felt like what I had done wasn't necessarily right. Glenn Motel describes himself as a Marine Corps Gulf War veteran for peace and social justice. He grew up in a small Pennsylvania town, and he was 17 when he joined the Marines with a self-described great desire to serve his country and to defend democracy. The military has been a long tradition in his family, and there was never any question whether he would do his 4 years. Glenn joined in 1987 and came out in late 1991. In those 4 years, Glenn began to change his views. He ended up in the Persian Gulf War, but by the time he got there, his views had begun to change. I immediately began to question my decision when I arrived in boot camp. Boot camp itself was a culture shock to begin with. In the Marine Corps boot camp, you're trained to be a killer, basically. There's no nice way to put it. Ingrained in that is a lot of racism and a lot of things that were against values I was also taught growing up. So I was taught to respect the military, but I was also taught to various religious and moral values. I believe that what I was experiencing in boot camp was counter to those values. So it was an immediate contradiction. I felt that contradiction throughout my time in the service. After boot camp, I began reading American history, seeing films about the Vietnam War era, and learning about the anti-war movement of that time, studying history that we didn't learn in high school. It seemed that American history always ended with World War II, and there was never enough time at the end of the year to cover what happened after World War II. Even that history was uncritical and just handed down to us from the point of view of America was always the shining city on the hill kind of perspective. So by the time the Gulf War came around, by the beginning of 1990 even, I was settling into somewhat of an anti-war position, even at that time. I was studying Vietnam and thinking that this kind of thing would never occur again, or could never occur again, now that our country has been through that. In August, with the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and then the military buildup, I was dismayed and I was in disbelief that this was happening again. I always felt that somehow it would stop. At the time, I wasn't anti-war, as I would say I'm anti-war today. I was not taking a pacifist position. I believed that there were things still worth fighting and dying for, such as democracy, human rights, and so forth, protection of my family and my way of life. I call it an evolution of my political thinking over the past 15 years. In the military itself, there's people with all different opinions. I found myself drawn to people with similar opinions that came from either lower socioeconomic backgrounds or minority groups. They seemed to have a more critical point of view from the start, so I was drawn to people like that. There were several of my fellow Marines who had some college experience, and I enjoyed hanging out with them because I could express these kinds of thoughts. And I did express this even to my direct supervisors and so forth. I had a fairly liberal unit, so I was fortunate for that, where that kind of thing was not looked down upon. I was a field radio operator, and I worked at a communication unit, the 9th Combat Battalion, out of Camp Pendleton. When we were over there, we were stationed at Camp 5 in Saudi Arabia. They already had barracks set up. Saudi Arabians have migrants come in to do a lot of menial tasks from places like the Philippines. So they already had these camps set up, but we turned it into a military encampment. I provided radio watch for the troops that were in the front. Perhaps you've seen it in films when a radio man is with a platoon, say, and he's calling in for aerial bombardment or something, and he calls the central command. I would be the person he was speaking to if I was on radio watch that evening. I didn't have a chance personally, and I thank God for this, to see the devastation. I know people from my unit who were actually on the Marine Expeditionary Force. Many of my friends, they just saw many, many dead bodies and charred bodies, the result of these bombs that fell. Any Iraqis they did meet were surrendering at the time. I don't know what my friends witnessed, but I've read reports of unarmed Iraqis being shot in half as they were trying to surrender. I just remember the looks on their faces after the ground war was over and they came back to Camp 5 before the transition home. These were guys that were happy-go-lucky guys, and I used to party with them and everything. And their faces were as if they had just seen a ghost. In many ways they had, I found out later, but they didn't want to talk about what they had just seen. They were visibly changed. I could tell just by looking at them. I can't speak for them, but what has gone through my mind since that time of questioning of how could this be in any way right? How could my country that I love, that I agreed to serve, have participated in such devastation? Charles Sheehan Miles also comes from a family with a long history of military service. They all just assumed that he would continue the tradition. He joined the Army in April 1990, about a year after high school. He finished boot camp about a week after Iraq invaded Kuwait. Charles went straight from basic training to Saudi Arabia. His time in the Persian Gulf changed his life, and ever since he has tirelessly spoken out against war, and especially the coming war against Iraq. I was an Abrams tank crewman, and during the war my unit, the 24th Infantry Division, we invaded Iraq from Saudi Arabia. We went up north as far as the Euphrates River Valley. I fought in a ground unit against the Iraqi troops. We were involved in a number of direct combat engagements against Iraqi forces. I felt like I was on Mars when I got back to the States and saw the TV coverage, because it was all so pretty, clean, and precise. It was none of those things. Our first engagement was chaotic. It was crazy. We came out of a sandstorm right into a dug-in infantry brigade of Iraqis. It was relatively close quarters, close enough that we could see the Iraqi soldiers from 50 meters away as we shot at them and they shot at us. My unit took some casualties in that battle. A number of people were wounded. The Iraqis, I couldn't even guess how many were killed, but it was many of them. They fought very hard, but they didn't have the kind of equipment we had. They didn't have the range. They didn't have the ability to fight back. It was by no means a balanced or even fight. I don't think the military planners intended it to be. We went in there with overwhelming force and rolled over these people. The next morning, very early in the morning of February 26th, my unit was just over on the far side of the highway approaching the river. There was a large logistics base or something for the Iraqis. I really didn't have a good feel for it. It was night. We were in our tanks, and all I had was a picture of maybe 100 meters to our front. We were there waiting for fuel trucks and ammunition to catch up with us so we could refuel and move on. I woke up. We took turns sleeping because we had been up 2 or 3 days at that point. I woke up hearing cries on the radio that there were trucks coming to our position. My platoon sergeant and I climbed up on top of our tank, and we saw these two trucks. One of the tanks fired and hit one of the trucks, and it was a fuel truck. It splashed burning diesel fuel all over the other truck. The other truck was a troop truck. Men ran out on fire. I didn't know how many of them. We did what we were trained to do. We shot them all and killed them. The human thing to do when you see someone on fire isn't to shoot them. It's to help them out, to take a blanket and put out the fire. For me, that was a real watershed moment because it changed the nature of the way you look at war in a very, very personal way. It took me years to be able to discuss that or talk about what happened, or to really learn to live with myself. But the war went on. Before the sun came up, we moved out and rolled towards Basra. Not long after that, we got into further engagements. Then there was a huge engagement 2 days after the ceasefire, which was mind-boggling to me. My division, the 24th Infantry Division, attacked and destroyed a retreating Iraqi division that was coming up north out of Kuwait. This was in the oil fields. The goal at that point, our orders, were to destroy all the equipment, to destroy all the tanks and trucks. If we saw people, we were to shoot them if they were armed or otherwise let them go. The devastation and chaos was literally indescribable. We were on this little two-lane causeway through this swamp, and it was just packed with hundreds and hundreds of burning vehicles. It was crazy. The whole thing was indescribably chaotic, and you know we killed a lot of people. There's no way around that. The reason I talk about this is because what got broadcast in the States at the time was, oh, look at this pretty smart bomb going down the shaft of this empty building in the middle of the night. That's not what this was about. Jeff Patterson grew up in the Central Valley of California. It's a place that plays a big part in feeding the rest of the country, but it can be like a prison for an 18-year-old looking for a future. Jeff joined the Marines at 18 because, in his words, he wanted to be a badass fighting machine. Over the next 4 years as an artillery controller and traveling the world with the Marines, Jeff began to see the people of the world in a different light. By the time he was ordered to the Gulf War, Jeff was a changed man. He became the first active duty soldier to refuse orders to go to war in the Persian Gulf. I served my 4 years, and I was a few weeks short of my end of active duty service, looking forward to going back to school when the Iraq War kicked off. And based on what I'd learned, how we were interacting with those peoples where I was at, and the things I'd heard from my buddies coming back from Central America, talking about helping out Contras down there and stuff going down in Beirut, I came to the conclusion, with some help of friends, that it would be in the best interest of the people of the world for me not to participate in the first Gulf War. I basically came to the conclusion that whatever the military could do to me for refusing to fight that war, it would be pretty insignificant compared to what we were going to do to the people of Iraq. I sort of knew that firsthand because I was trained as a nuclear warhead technician for our artillery unit, and we were promised that we'd get to nuke the ragheads if anything went wrong. My commanding officer, to make us more relaxed about going over there and make us not worry so much, promised me particularly that if anything went wrong, I would be able to assemble the nuclear warhead and nuke the ragheads until they all glow. That was his way of reassuring us that we'd be taken care of. So I held a press conference to get the word out, because I figured the military wasn't going to look kindly on my ideas, and that they'd probably want to disappear me to the Middle East as quick as possible, unless I got the word out. I threw together this press conference at the last minute, and basically I just tried to articulate how I felt, and that I wasn't going to be a pawn in America's power plays for profit and oil in the Middle East. That's the way I looked at it, having tens of thousands and later hundreds of thousands of basically pawns going out there, being shot up with anthrax vaccines and given toxic amounts of BP pills and Botox pills and all these other things that are supposed to keep you safe, that obviously have contributed to the illness of 100,000 troops from the first Gulf War and 10,000 dying from the Gulf War syndrome. I went back and forth with the military about applying for a discharge as a conscientious objector, and that takes forever sometimes. In my case, the military decided that I wasn't actually sincere enough to be a conscientious objector, denied my claim to be discharged, and ordered me onto the next outbound plane to Saudi Arabia. At that point, I actually just sat down on the runway and refused to get on the plane. Because of the publicity I had, they didn't just shackle me and throw me on the plane like they did to people later as the war progressed and other people refused to get on the plane, much like I did. I went to Pearl Harbor Brig. I did a couple of months there. I was in the middle of a court-martial because I was a, quote, threat to national security of the United States. Probably today I'd end up in Guantanamo or something, but back then they kept me in Pearl Harbor. It was basically only because people protested outside the base, this was before the war actually kicked off, that the military decided that it actually wasn't in their best interest to pursue my prosecution. Instead of getting the expected 5 years in Leavenworth, they gave me an other-than-honorable discharge. One thing people ask me is how was it that I became the first person to publicly declare that war was wrong from within the military? It was basically because one person challenged me to do the right thing. It wasn't go or don't go, it was actually do the right thing. For 4 years, I'd spent my life not doing the right thing, but doing what I was told. As far as I'm concerned, I've never regretted for a moment what I've done. Any nightmares I have are about what if I'd actually just followed orders, if I just did what I was told, if I had to be a part of the carnage that's led to the last 12 years of sanctions and 1.5 million Iraqi dead. That's the nightmare I have. I think people saw what it meant to support the troops during the last Gulf War. There is no way to put that as your primary political orientation. If you are starting from support the troops, bring them home, we want peace, then still when the troops are over there fighting the war, you are left with primarily supporting the troops, and that means supporting what they are doing. I am completely sympathetic and understanding of where people are coming from, but if you are actually going to be part of a worldwide movement to stop this war and other wars, we've got to call out what's really going on. We have to support the troops who refuse to fight. And that's not to say we diss the other troops or whatever, but it's more of a challenge to us to do the outreach, to let those troops know what the war is all about. They don't know. They've been indoctrinated not to think about those sort of things. And once we do that, then it's our responsibility to speak out in whatever way to help them along to do the right thing. We need to lay the foundation for people to step out in a bold way and say, hell no, we're not going to go, this war is wrong, and call out other people to take the right stand against all this. And I have been reading from an article by Michael Slate, Gulf War Vets, Resisting and Telling the Truth.
We now take you live to the White Stog, where President George W. Bush is holding a special news conference for the benefit of the European Union. That is the voice of the German translator that we hear in the background.
To all the men and women of the United States Armed Forces now in the Middle East. In this conflict, America has no regard for conventions of war. For innocent men, women, and children. No regard for the great civilization. The religious faiths they practice, or rules of morality. Now that conflict has come, America has no regard for its own people, for the families of our military or millions of Americans praying with you, for the safety of your loved ones, or for the protection of the innocent. For your sacrifice, a final atrocity will require our sustained commitment. All those who serve will require our sustained commitment. A campaign on the harsh terrain of a nation as large as California could be longer and more difficult than some predict. The only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force. And I assure you, this will not be a campaign of half measures. And we will accept no outcome but victory. We come to Iraq to restore control of that country to early stages of military operations. And we will accept no outcome but victory.
Tom Hartmann lived and worked in Germany during the 1980s and is the author of over a dozen books, including Unequal Protection and The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. The following article by Hartmann, When Democracy Failed, The Warnings of History, has been making the rounds of the Internet. The 70th anniversary wasn't noticed in the United States and was barely reported in the corporate media. But the Germans remembered well that fateful day 70 years ago, February 27, 1933. They commemorated the anniversary by joining in demonstrations for peace that mobilized citizens all across the world. It started when the government, in the midst of a worldwide economic crisis, received reports of an imminent terrorist attack. A foreign ideologue had launched feeble attacks on a few famous buildings, but the media largely ignored his relatively small efforts. The intelligence services knew, however, that the odds were he would eventually succeed. Historians are still arguing whether or not rogue elements in the intelligence service helped the terrorist. The most recent research implies they did not. But the warnings of investigators were ignored at the highest levels, in part because the government was distracted. The man who claimed to be the nation's leader had not been elected by a majority vote, and the majority of citizens claimed he had no right to the powers he coveted. He was a simpleton, some said, a cartoon character of a man who saw things in black and white terms, and he didn't have the intellect to understand the subtleties of running a nation in a complex and internationalist world. His coarse use of language reflecting his political roots in a southernmost state, and his simplistic and often inflammatory nationalistic rhetoric offended the aristocrats, foreign leaders, and the well-educated elite in the government and media. And as a young man, he joined a secret society with an occult-sounding name and bizarre initiation rituals that involved skulls and human bones. Nonetheless, he knew the terrorist was going to strike, although he didn't know where or when, and he had already considered his response. When an aide brought him word that the nation's most prestigious building was ablaze, he verified it was the terrorist who had struck, then rushed to the scenes and called a press conference. "You are now witnessing the beginning of a great epoch in history," he proclaimed, standing in front of the burned-out building, surrounded by national media. "This fire," he said, his voice trembling with emotion, "is the beginning." He used the occasion, quote, "a sign from God," he called it, to declare an all-out war on terrorism and its ideological sponsors. "A people," he said, "who traced their origins to the Middle East and found motivation for their evil deeds in their religion." 2 weeks later, the first detention center for terrorists was built in Orenburg to hold the first suspected allies of the infamous terrorist. In a national outburst of patriotism, the leader's flag was everywhere, even printed large in newspapers suitable for window display. Within 4 weeks of the terrorist attack, the nation's now popular leader had pushed through legislation in the name of combating terrorism and fighting the philosophy he said spawned it, that suspended constitutional guarantees of free speech, privacy, and habeas corpus. Police could now intercept mail and wiretap phones. Suspected terrorists could be imprisoned without specific charges and without access to their lawyers. Police could sneak into people's homes without warrants if the cases involved terrorism. To get his patriotic decree on the protection of people and state passed over the objections of concerned legislators and civil libertarians, he agreed to put a 4-year sunset provision on it. If the national emergency provoked by the terrorist attack was over by then, the freedoms and rights would be returned to the people, and the police agencies would be restrained. Legislators would later say they hadn't had the time to read the bill before voting on it. Immediately after the passage of the Anti-Terrorism Act, his federal police agencies stepped up their program of arresting suspicious persons and holding them without access to lawyers or courts. In the first year, only a few hundred were interred, and those who objected were largely ignored by the mainstream press, which was afraid to offend and thus lose access to a leader with such high popularity ratings. Citizens who protested the leader in public, and there were many, quickly found themselves confronting the newly empowered police's batons, gas, and jail cells, or fenced off in protest zones safely out of earshot of the leader's public speeches. In the meantime, he was taking almost daily lessons in public speaking, learning to control his tonality, gestures, and facial expressions. He became a very competent orator. Within the first months after that terrorist attack, at the suggestion of a political advisor, he brought a formerly obscure word into common usage. He wanted to stir a racial pride among his countrymen, so instead of referring to the nation by its name, he began to refer to it as the homeland, a phrase publicly promoted in the introduction to a 1934 speech recorded in Leni Riefenstahl's famous propaganda movie, Triumph of the Will. As hoped, people's hearts swelled with pride, and the beginning of an us-versus-them mentality was sown. Our land was the homeland, citizens thought. All others were simply foreign lands. We are the true people, he suggested, the only ones worthy of our nation's concern. If bombs fall on others, or human rights are violated in other nations and it makes our lives better, it's of little concern to us. Playing on this new nationalism and exploiting a disagreement with the French over his increasing militarism, he argued that any international body that didn't act first and foremost in the best interest of his own nation was neither relevant nor useful. Thus, he withdrew his country from the League of Nations in October 1933, and then negotiated a separate naval armaments agreement with Anthony Eden of the United Kingdom to create a worldwide military ruling elite. His propaganda minister orchestrated a campaign to ensure the people that he was a deeply religious man and that his motivations were rooted in Christianity. He even proclaimed the need for a revival of the Christian faith across his nation, what he called a new Christianity. Every man in his rapidly growing army wore a belt buckle that declared, "Gott mit uns," God is with us, and most of them fervently believed it was true. Within a year of the terrorist attack, the nation's leader determined that the various local police and federal agencies around the nation were lacking the clear communication and overall coordinated administration necessary to deal with the terrorist threat facing the nation, particularly those citizens who were of Middle Eastern ancestry and thus probably terrorist and communist sympathizers, and various troublesome intellectuals and liberals. he proposed a single new national agency to protect the security of the homeland, consolidating the actions of dozens of previously independent police, border, and investigative agencies under a single leader. He appointed one of his most trusted associates to be the leader of this new agency, the Central Security Office for the Homeland, and gave it a role in the government equal to the other major departments. His assistant who dealt with the press noted that, since the terrorist attack, radio and press are at our disposal. Those voices questioning the legitimacy of their nation's leader or raising questions about his checkered past had by now faded from the public's recollection as his Central Security Office began advertising a program encouraging people to phone in tips about suspicious neighbors. This program was so successful that the names of some of the people denounced were soon being broadcast on radio stations. Those denounced often included opposition politicians and celebrities who dared to speak out, a favorite target of his regime and the media he now controlled through intimidation and ownership by corporate allies. To consolidate his power, he concluded that government alone wasn't enough. He reached out to industry and forged an alliance, bringing former executives of the nation's largest corporations into high government positions. A flood of government money poured into corporate coffers to fight the war against the Middle Eastern ancestry terrorists lurking within the homeland and to prepare for wars overseas. He encouraged large corporations friendly to him to acquire media outlets and other industrial concerns across the nation, particularly those previously owned by suspicious people of Middle Eastern ancestry. He built powerful alliances with industry. One corporate ally got the lucrative contract worth millions to build the first large-scale detention center for enemies of the state. Soon, more would follow. Industry flourished. But after an interval of peace following the terrorist attack, voices of dissent again arose within and without the government. Students had started an active program opposing him, later known as the White Rose Society, and leaders of nearby nations were speaking out against his bellicose rhetoric. He needed a diversion, something to direct people away from the corporate cronyism being exposed in his own government, questions of his possibly illegitimate rise to power, and the oft-voiced concerns of civil libertarians about the people being held in detention without due process or access to attorneys or family. With his number two man, a master at manipulating the media, he began a campaign to convince the people of the nation that a small, limited war was necessary. Another nation was harboring many of the suspicious Middle Eastern people, and even though its connection with the terrorists who had set afire the nation's most important building was tenuous at best, it held resources their nation badly needed if they were to have room to live and maintain their prosperity. He called a press conference and publicly delivered an ultimatum to the leader of the other nation, provoking an international uproar. He claimed the right to strike preemptively in self-defense, and nations across Europe at first denounced him for it, pointing out that it was a doctrine only claimed in the past by nations seeking worldwide empire, like Caesar's Rome or Alexander's Greece. It took a few months, an intense international debate and lobbying with European nations, but after he personally met with the leader of the United Kingdom, finally a deal was struck. After the military action began, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain told the nervous British people that giving in to this leader's new first strike doctrine would bring peace for our time. Thus Hitler annexed Austria in a lightning move,